On our next episode, we interview Matt Hastings, CEO and founder of Alphabrook. Alphabrook works with thousands of federal contracting executives to provide difficult-to-find customer market intelligence. Matt takes us through his lifetime journey of being connected to the government, from growing up in a military family, interning at the Pentagon, to now forming Alphabrook. In this episode, Matt shows us how a true leader intertwines the lessons that they learned from mentors and their past experiences in order to create one of the fastest growing intel firms in the region.
You're listening to the Northern Virginia Business Podcast. My name is Jessica Dubois.
And I'm Derek Wynn. Here, we chronicle the stories of successful business owners and executives who stand out from the crowd.
Whether you're driven by purpose or profit, tune in to learn how these leaders have built successful businesses,
helping to shape the landscape of Northern Virginia.
My dad was in the Marine Corps, and so we sort of, when I was very young, like 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years old, we sort of were moving up and down the East Coast. So we were in North Carolina, Camp Lejeune. My dad went to the Naval War College in Rhode Island. And my mom was, you know, always on my dad, like, hey, let's settle down. Let's figure out a chance. Let's create an opportunity for our kids to really plant themselves. And I don't know that she was really wanting to be like a general's wife, if you will. And nothing wrong with that. We need those. But for her, it wasn't the right thing. And so it sort of worked out that during the Clinton administration, he was downsizing the military and actually creating incentives. If you hit a certain MOS, you'd been in for so long. And my dad, just those stars aligned. And so long story short, he got out at 15 years and they gave retirement of 20. So not a bad deal. And then he went and worked in the counterterrorism office at State Department. And that was a really good thing for our family, in fact, because, you know, they created some consistency in our lives. We had already, my dad had served and we had dealt with making and losing friends and moving. So that was really helpful. And then from there, I'm one of the few people that grew up in Northern Virginia. I find that people either come here or were here and then are trying to get out. And it's got this intoxicating pull where it's like everyone wants to act like they don't want to be here, but they don't leave. And there's something about it. It's like the heartbeat of the world. There's just a lot of activity and it's a very important place, both economically and politically. One of my internships, I was working in the Pentagon and this guy at my church who ran a business, his name was William Skinner, great guy. He's still out there somewhere working, was trying to find some interns. And I said, hey, I'll intern. And what we were doing was just making copies. And my job was to make copies and go to all the different offices in the Pentagon. And by the way, the Pentagon's like, it's not a normal building. It's like it's a rat maze. There's no cheese at the end, but it's just like, it's a cornfield with drywall. And so I got really smart about like where all the cool stuff was. I walked into some rooms a couple times accidentally where there was just screens full of like data points. Like, this isn't a room I'm supposed to be in. And so it, you know, I had a really great experience. And that was actually my first experience working on a government contract. Who knows what they were billing me out on? Probably a lot more than what they were paying me as an intern. But what I would say is that just taught me how to work. It built resourcefulness in me. It also demystified things. Like, I'd see the Pentagon on TV and I'm like, well, I'm in there every day. And it made me feel comfortable with like being in the professional world at a very young age. And then I would say going to college, majoring in finance, and then really doing internships all throughout college for federal contractors. So I worked at a company called Touchstone Consulting, which was sort of a higher end consulting firm. There was these two founders, Chris McGough and Steve Lynott, and another guy named John Miller, brilliant business people that were mentoring me. I'm in college and I was doing financial work there because I was a financial major in college. And I was working on the same floor as them because I was working for the CFO, and I was going to lunch with these guys and they're mentoring me. And I'm like 20, I'm 19, 20, 21 years old. By the time I graduated and took a job with Booz Allen, I mean, I was ready to go. I was probably more like someone who had worked for 4 or 5 years in the professional space, except you have to add in all the mentorship I had. So Booz Allen was an interesting place because I was sort of had been at some small businesses and then at Booz Allen was working in the market intelligence space there, but it was a really large business and was there for a short period of time. And then the Carlyle Group came in and made an acquisition and bought out a lot of that business. But I would say the beginning, the very early parts before I even, as I'm transitioning into my real career, was incredibly important into my overall development.
You know, working in the Pentagon as a young professional is very unique. And I feel like the government contracting world is kind of like a secret here to Northern Virginia. And of course, it's nationally and global, but so many other parts of the United States like are unaware of the opportunities. And I feel like you were basically born into that. What fascinated you about it when you're working in the Pentagon, when you're working with government contracting? Was there like a passion that came within you as you're working?
Yeah, that's a great question, Jess. I think it really grew this curiosity. Because I was like, well, wait a second, how does this all work? And then I would think this person was a government guy. And he's like, no, I'm a contractor. I'm like, what's a contractor? I'm like, well, wait, how's this work? Were you ever government? Oh, no, you were active duty. And you just real, and like, there's all this alphabet soup. So I was probably confused entirely every day, not knowing who, like what roles people were in. There were all kinds of working dynamics where people didn't like each other. I didn't know. I would joke. I would be like connecting people and not realizing there was a social dynamic. And so I think just really getting that exposure, it didn't really grow this a huge curiosity for me around like national defense or anything like that. I think what it did was it just created an overall business curiosity of like, how do things work? And like, how do contractors build a government? And like, I would go to the CEO who I knew went to my church and say like, how did you win this contract? And that was where things started really formulating in my mind. Oh, you submitted a proposal? Well, how did you know to submit a proposal? And just asking these questions. And that, I would say, Jessica, more than anything, a lot of failures. I don't remember probably all the stupid stuff I did. I probably got lost all the time. There were times where I was just late to work and having to really grow up professionally and be like, no, like if you say you're going to do something, you've got to be there on time. You've got to show up. And just getting mentorship. You know, when you're around that many military people, you know, there's a lot of people, both men and women, that took me under their wing and were like, you're new here, aren't you? And I just think there's a whole community in there. You know, when you think about 9/11 and what happened, I think if you've never really worked in there for a period of time, you don't realize how tight knit and how that community is. And it's almost like a, I don't know why, I was just like thinking like District 9. It's like an alien spaceship, and not really, but it's like everyone knows each other and there's community there. And we used to eat in the courtyard and you'd see the same people in the beautiful courtyard. And, you know, and so I think for me, it was a really great experience, but really just taught me how much I didn't know.
So you go into the contracting realm, you do some BD work, right? So you are basically helping to pursue those contracts and help companies win. And, you know, you get the vision for Alphabrook. So how did that actually happen?
That's a great transitioning question. When I was at Booz Allen, I was really marketing their GWACs. You know, Booz Allen had all these government-wide acquisition contract vehicles, and I think most people in the Northern Virginia area would know what those are, but if you're listening and don't know, basically the government creates lists of buyers that are pre-qualified. And if you think about like, if you had any task you'd want to contract out, you'd rather maybe work with people that you've already vetted that are already good at said subject material. And so the government does that. And I was learning about all the contract vehicles too. But really at Booz Allen, it wasn't as enterprising. It was being in a really big place and it was more contractual. There was market intel going on, but it was just a much bigger operation where you didn't get to see the full value chain of, okay, I'm doing this every day and here's the output. And once the acquisition happened, I ended up getting recruited to this company. And this is a great thing to talk about because it was a company called Kadix Systems. And I hope one of the themes of my time on this podcast is that you think of people that were meaningful in my life. Joe Helfrich, he actually hired me at Kadix Systems. And Kadix was this 8A woman-owned small business doing, you know, sub $10 million a year in revenue. And really within 3 years, myself and Joe and other executives there grew that business into $100 million plus, and it sold. The bookings were over $100 million, and it sold for like $50 million plus in a very short period of time. And we did that by getting spots on contract vehicles. But a lot of the knowledge about contract vehicles and teaming agreements and really the day-to-day blocking and tackling, it started a little bit at Booz, but it was really developed and crafted at Kadix Systems. And Joe Helfrich was this guy. He's amazing at time management and just sort of, I don't know if he would be okay with me saying this, but sort of no muss, no fuss. Like, hey, just get your stuff done. And like, he's going to mentor you and just like incredibly focused. And that taught me some really to take your work really seriously. And that if you spend time working on a deal, that means the company's paying you. You're taking risk, you're investing your time on a deal. And if that doesn't work out because you didn't check all the boxes or you weren't as thorough as you should have been, you know, that's, if you're a private company, that goes back to the owners. You know, they've lost money there. If you're a public company, it goes back to the shareholders. And sort of building that professional rigor at Kadix was incredible. One other point, Joe Helfrich, and I just want to, you know, I love the guy. I called him like a month ago. I said, dude, I just want you to know. He's like, what's wrong? I'm like, no, I just want you to know. Thank you. And he was like, that's the best call I've ever gotten. Cause I just, so many times the way I lead and the way I do things at Alphabrook, I've taken from him. He also just didn't pull things back. He showed me the whole process. So we would work on, I was working on all kinds of deals. He'd say, hey, Matt, once he realized I was capable, he would say, we need you to go write a page or two on for this proposal. It's weak. Go do some research and write a page or two on this. We would work on different deals together. We went to meetings together. lots of lunches, just talking through strategies. And really what I learned in maybe 36 months there, however long it was, would I honestly think would have taken 10 years at a lot of places had I not had the concentrated mentorship and had I not been at a place that was sort of turning into like a rocket ship. Because when there's a lot going on, you just got to do a lot more. And the more reps you get on different types of bidding experiences, like I was probably involved. I remember in September of, I forget the year, but in 1 month we bid 28 proposals. And that was unheard of at that time. A lot of companies, a lot of our clients, small business clients, they'll bid 10 deals a year. And we were bidding 28 deals in a month. So I think that was transformational for me. And that's where everything really started clicking. My internship, you know, the experience at Booz Allen, and then, okay, boom, now I've seen it all. I've actually seen how you grow and became a lot more enterprising through that experience.
Well, it's funny you say that too. And you talk about the volume, you know, what is it? I think there's a book like, you know, 10,000 hours to be great at anything, right? So if you're doing the reps and you're doing the work and you're working around the clock kind of thing, you can get good fast, right? So how does Alphabrook kind of shorten that learning curve for those bidding opportunities for your clients? Because from what I understand and what we've talked about in this, you know, there's a ton of market intel firms out there. You know, you could probably throw a stone from any building in DC and probably find someone who knows something about something or someone in government contracting. But from what I understand, there's a lot of those systems are basically just, they tell you kind of what's out there, but you're putting a narrative to the actual work. How does that happen? What does that look like?
I can answer that question and also tie it from sort of transitioning from Cadix. I remember when I was at Cadix, we were bidding a lot of deals, but we weren't talking to the customer much. And I remember going to Joe and saying, "Hey, I just want to do cold calling." And he was like, "You want to do cold calling?" I'm like, "Yeah, I just want to dial. I want to smile and dial. I want to call people. I want to go talk with government people." And I think that's one thing. And I failed terribly. I called people, they shut me down. They were like, "Who are you?" I mean, I was terrible at it. It was so bad that Joe said, "Let me write you like a call script, and you need to follow the call script." At one point, I was like, "Okay," and that was probably a good thing. But really what happened was I was just calling, talking to government people. And I got to the point where I was doing 50, 60 calls a day. And this is the thing I've noticed about other people that have found success. Not that I don't think I'm any mark of success, but I think the people that have reached their dreams will say that. They don't think that things that are really difficult or like that where you got to grind, you just got to put out a lot of effort. It's not really weird to them. And in fact, they get this weird kick out of it. It's like, they're a little crazy in the sense that, and for me, that was never weird. I would be energized after 100 calls. But what started happening was, and this is a good segue into Alphabrook, was that I started realizing that, wait, some of these people are sharing stuff with me. And I got so good at it that I was bringing pages of information, of intel internally from the program management teams behind the RFPs we were bidding. Now, we used to win deals just because we were an 8A, we top 500, all this stuff. And by the way, all those awards, you know, you got to pay $500 for it. And 10,000 people apply and they choose 500. It's, I mean, I got a little bit of a pet peeve on that. We could have been on all the lists. We don't apply because I just have a fundamental thing. I'm like, I'd rather grow really fast silently anyway. But once I realized that I could get intel on my own, that's when the seeds for Alphabrook really started planting. And we were winning those deals too, where I was grabbing intel and when they were infusing it. Alphabrook is sort of the accumulation of all those experiences, but really developing a process and a methodology for connecting with the end customer. I think the biggest change I've seen in government over the last, I mean, I've been in federal contracting, it's scary to say, for like 13, 14 years. I'm still a really young guy. I'm in my 30s. What I would say is that there's been a fracturing of trust. And with the rise in protests, it seems like if a company loses now, it's like people just expect them to protest. There's a whole industry of attorneys, and you see people on LinkedIn, like, let's have a big meeting and talk about how you can be better at protests. And I'm like, okay, well, I'm not sure that that's conducive to better relationships. But because of that macro lack of trust and lack of communication, I think it's opened up even more of an opportunity for us to set ourselves apart. And I think you know that we don't bid on federal contracts. We've said, listen, we're going to be a true third party. We're going to help the government. We're not going to take any money from the government. Contractors will fund us. But by uniquely positioning ourselves to get information, you know, we're essentially a trusted third party to help the government get better solutions. But the key thing for us is scalability. So you referred to lots of market intel. There's lots of BD platforms out there. What they're doing is they're just pulling more surfacey data. They're going to the government databases, like what used to be FPDS. It's now SAM. Or beta.sam, whatever they're calling it. And they're pulling these a lot of quantitative data, contractual data, estimated dollars. We're going in and actually having storyboarded conversations and almost doing interviews. I've said before, it's almost like a podcast where you're having conversations and then we document it, we transcribe the feedback and then send that to our clients. By the way, where did that whole idea come from? It just came from a young guy just wanting to do 100 cold calls and see what the heck would happen. And again, and why did I want to do 100 cold calls? I was a curious creature. Why was I curious? I don't know. That internship at the Pentagon had really sprung up some energy and some curiosity in me. And so you see how the different segments of your career sort of tie together and lead you to a place where you can do something really special like we're doing at Alphabrook.
Well, and you forfeited the right to bid on contracts in order to help companies grow. Were you fearful that that may not turn out the way that you thought it would?
I mean, for sure. I guess, I could sit here and act really noble about it, that like we forfeited a ton of opportunity. But the reality is we did that at the very beginning. So we never had to like shed contracts or say, okay, we're changing course or we're going to forego revenue. It was something we decided at the very beginning. The other thing is, you know, I worked a lot of weekends at Cadex. One of the pains, and I'm sure people in your audience can relate to this, is in federal contracting, the best time of year to bid deals is also the best time of year it is to be at the beach. And so what we all do is we all work our tails off all year. And then right after October 1, when the cold starts coming in, we're like, okay, we'll go vacation. The whole idea, though, is that I was a little bit burnt out. Now, people might say, this whippersnapper. People would still call me a whippersnapper. You know, I'm still too young to be burnt out. But the reality was I did work really hard for a lot of weekends. I remember being newly married and my wife would be like, what are we going to do today? I was like, oh, I forgot to tell you. I've got to go up to Arlington. I got to go work. She was like, what? And I was like, yeah. And then it became normal. And so you do that for 3 or 4 years. And I would also deal with a lot of compliance things, looking at compliance proposals, and all of it was government regulation related. So I would just say that I got to the point where honestly, my desire, it wasn't like I had some enormous desire to build a federal contracting company, because I felt like I had already made my contributions towards doing that. It was a little bit burnout, if I'm allowed to say that. To be real, like there was never a passion to build a federal contracting company, but there is a deep, deep, overwhelming compassion to help federal contractors be successful. And ultimately, sort of the whole loop on this is that federal contractors are successful by writing better proposals because we're giving them better intel that's customer-centric. And then guess what? Government's more successful. We've already done research on COVID. We're doing research on vaccines. And it's not that we're medical experts, because we're not, but we're doing research on what the government wants. They're telling us, here's what we need, X, Y, Z. Here's what's not going well. Here's what we need to mitigate. Then we give that to the experts, and then they can go help them. And so I think we view ourselves as that messenger, as that, you know, that broker to help government be more successful, because we know that the direct communication in many cases isn't working. There's a major breakdown, as I already mentioned. But to answer your question, we have forfeited a lot of opportunity. Most people in the federal in the Northern Virginia area are selling to the government. One of the reasons people hit those top 100 lists so quickly is they'll win one contract worth $10 million. And then, you know, that's why we've got all the staffing companies. They'll call up a staffing company and be like, I've got to get 50 people on a contract. And so people balloon their revenue really quick. The other thing I'm proud about at Alphabrook is we don't have that luxury. We're growing really fast, despite not having any balloon contracts. You know, every contract we get is pretty equalized. Now, the nice thing is we're heavily diversified too. So we don't have all of our eggs in one big contract bucket from a revenue standpoint. So I think the things that have been difficult have actually created a really wide moat for us as well in terms of the security and the financial, you know, continuity of our business.
Let me kind of dig into that, because I think this is probably also something a lot of our listeners would be interested in, which is, you know, what are the things that they should be transitioning toward? You know, you mentioned COVID, vaccines, you know, there was a lot of push toward PPE, so on and so forth early on. What does that landscape look like now? And what do you think that landscape is going to look like down the road? Like, what should people really be leaning into at this point?
I mean, I just always go back to technology. I do a lot of investing on the side, and I love technology companies. And I don't think it's technology for technology's sake. I think it's technology applied. So it's like technology on a domain. So I'm really curious to see like how machine learning is going to accelerate, you know, vaccine testing. Like, I'm really curious about how space exploration is going to change, you know, defense strategies. I mean, you're hearing about all kinds of things going on where satellites are, and this is public, like satellites are going up in space and they're doing all they can track. Now we've got satellites that can track when other countries, are launching, like, or if they were to launch a nuclear missile, we could track that immediately from space. I think if you look at where the most innovative private sector companies are, you'll see where the government will be in 10 years. I think telehealth, right? My wife actually stubbed her toe the other day and she woke up this morning and it's like, I don't know if she wants me talking about her toes on a podcast, but oh well, it's too late now. Sorry, Lindsay. But her toe is all swollen. And she's like, I'm not going to go to the doctor. We got four kids, by the way. We got four boys under the age of seven. So we're pretty busy. And she's holding our littlest in her arms. She's like, I'm like, sorry, babe, I can't help you this morning. But she said, is there like, can I call a doctor? She's like, honestly, 90%. She says this. She's like, 90% of what I need, I don't even need to go in. And that's like a little, as a business guy, I'm no longer even thinking about my wife's toe. I'm just like, I gotta go invest in a telehealth company. I'm like, I gotta get out of here and go find a telehealth company. But the funny thing is, these little anecdotal things like that in your own personal life, we're gonna see a more virtualized world. I think innovative manufacturing is gonna increase. I don't care like which party's in office. I think you've gotta do that to build. Let's face it, we couldn't create our own PPE. I think that when you look at the most cutting edge technology and apply that to health or vaccines or national security, I think that's where you're going to see, you know, the most innovation and the most growth.
We know, you know, the big story is Amazon HQ2 coming to Northern Virginia. How do you see that impacting the area?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I think it's a must topic to discuss because it's a huge impact on the area. I think overall it's positive. I think there's a reason why every single state was courting Amazon to come to them. I mean, I've done a lot of reading on this. Amazon basically said, give us all the data. Here's all the data we need. You send your proposals. And in your proposals, we want this and this and this and this and this. And it was all the data. It was all the sensitive data that they wouldn't even share with us as taxpayers. And they did that because then they've got the data. And then who's really good with data? Amazon, you know, like they can take data and draw conclusions better than anyone in the world. I mean, and so I think they were really smart too about choosing a location where they could have influence politically. It just makes a lot of sense. And I think at the time too, when they made that decision, I don't remember the exact timeline. I don't think it was clear about the cloud contract at the Pentagon. I think that was also like, hey, this makes a lot of sense to move here. This cloud contract is still, you know, being decided upon. And I think that decision to move there was before the Microsoft announcement. So I think that was just another factor where it's like, not that that made the primary decision. That probably was a small weighting in all of it, but that's an indication of the future growth in the public sector. I think Crystal City is a really smart decision because that's an area where if you've ever been down there, well, pre-COVID, there was less and less people there. Like if that's where you get the best bang for your buck on a building or on office, but you wouldn't get it like in Roslyn. You wouldn't get it in Ballston. That's a lot more expensive, but Crystal City, and then you've got all those shops and then, you know, they got this, I think they got the state to say that they'll help them build a train or a metro right to Reagan. So all of that to say, I think it's fantastic for the area. I will say that it's going to shake things up. I do believe, and you know, I've said this with other people, that some of the most talented developers and IT technical staff, you know, at the contractors, I think in this virtualized world, and especially with a heavy presence from Amazon, I think they're going to be maybe considering options in a way that, you know, they haven't previously considered options. I suspect that that'll happen. I think it'll make federal contractors better. They'll have to compete, whether it's benefits or in other areas, with the best companies in the world now, because it used to be you'd have to fly to the location where these big tech companies were. You'd have to go to Silicon Valley or other places. But I think even that's changed because I think what these tech companies are realizing is maybe the future isn't Silicon Valley. Maybe it's actually just where people are at. And you're seeing hiring strategies completely adjust. You're seeing multiple tech companies saying, we're forever remote. Well, the moment a company says we're forever remote, they don't care about hiring in a specific location anymore, which then means all the talent in DC is fair game for any company in the country and really any company in the world if they can conquer the time zone issues. We have a developer right now that works for us because we're doing some really innovative technology stuff, and he works out of England, and he's our developer for us. We're already... And we probably wouldn't have done that had we not gone through COVID. But when I'm coming into work every day and I'm sort of isolated physically, and I'm already, even the people that I used to work with in the office, they're all remote to me. It doesn't feel as weird to work with anyone remote, even people on different continents, really.
When you invested in Amazon years ago, you probably couldn't have predicted this, huh?
Well, no, I don't think that I would predict that they would, you know, have some of the success that they've had in the public sector. There is a cool story. I was always a fan of Amazon, and I have this interesting story. When I was in college, I sold books, sort of a funny story where you may remember in college at the end of the semester, you bring your book back and the bookstore will pay you $80 or $100 for your book. And you might've paid $150 or $200 for it. I had this really cool story where it's just maybe the young entrepreneur in college. And I was in the bookstore and I was buying books for the semester. And I found a book that was selling for like $150 from the bookstore. guess where I found that book for, it was like 2 cents. I'm not even kidding. They were just trying to get it off the shelf on Amazon. And I was like, oh my word. I'm like, this is like, I can make a ton of money on the spread here. So I bought like 5 of those books. I gave some to my friends and I said, you gotta give them back to me at the end of the semester. At the end of the semester, you know what I did? They were buying that book back for half the 150 for like $80 or 75. I returned all 5 of those books and the bookstore gave me $400. And so you know what I did the next day? I went on to Amazon and bought every single, it was a science book. I still remember some of the ISBN numbers of the books. I bought pallets of books and we were just pushing them through the return process. It's a really funny story. So I tripped a flag for returning more than like 30 books or something like that. And they called the police at our college and they interrogate me and they're interviewing me and they're like, show us your receipts. And I show them all my receipts and they're like, okay, just go talk to the bookstore manager. You're good. You did buy these. You didn't steal them from the bookstore. I go back to the bookstore, talk to the bookstore manager. She's like, you should have come and talked to me. She's this really sweet lady. She's like, you bring me as much as you want, sweetie. She's like, you bring those pallets, you get pallets, you drop them right here. I literally made like $20,000 or $30,000 just on a spread between, it was a science and a math book that I was buying on Amazon. The most amazing story is I took about half of that $15K back in the 2007 timeframe when Amazon was only at crazy number, $40, $50 a share. It was bouncing between $50 and $80 a share back then. And I bought like 350 shares of Amazon because I thought this is an amazing company. It just helped me make money. I'm going to own the stock. I didn't know that, you know, 15 years later or whatever it's been, or I guess a little less, I didn't know that it's a $3,200 per share stock right now. So I actually own over $1 million of stock in Amazon, and it's only 330 or 350 shares. I forget the exact amount. So I really love investing in companies. I also love investing in people. Most of the leadership team we have at Alphabrook has been there for many years and we invest in each other. They make me better. They tell me where I'm failing. They tell me where I need to grow. And I tell them the same thing. And we've developed this really tight culture where together we're growing as professionals. And so you can invest in companies, but like I said earlier, I've had a lot of people invest in me. If I were a stock, I was a low, low price at the beginning. And I'm probably still a pretty low price, but I wouldn't be the price I'm at right now if I didn't have people really investing and pouring into me in the earlier parts of my career.
That's pretty awesome. So we talk about this, you know, you come up in the government contracting realm, right? You've got your side hustle with investing. We might have to ask for investment tips after this, right? But you really focus and pour everything into what you're doing today. And you're growing a business that appears to be the only one like it. Yeah. I don't know who else would want to go and get the intel from contracting officers and everyone else. It's a tough job, right?
That's right.
But where do you see that going? Like what's next for you? What's next for the business? You know, we kind of talked about where the industry's going, where federal contracting's going. Where are you 5 years from now? Where's Alphabrook 5 years from now? What does your competition look like 5 years from now?
It's a great question. I always find those questions interesting because I always find that whatever I think will be 5 years from now, realistically, we're always better. So like when I was projecting a year or two out, when we first started, we always eclipsed those goals. And every year we end the calendar year and I'm like, I wonder if we're gonna have as good of a year next year, and it's always better. And I don't know, but it doesn't always feel like that. You feel like you're working hard or you feel like you're having setbacks along the way, whether it's personnel or customer or just you're trying to innovate and you're experiencing, you know, pushback on different things, just technically. Well, let me talk a little bit about where I think the industry is going from a market intel standpoint. I believe we're absolutely leading the industry. I think if you talk to the companies we work with, like IBM and, you know, Leidos and Northrop Grumman and Accenture and Deloitte, and Google, we're working with huge brands. And I think the reason that they work with us is because they say nobody else is as forward leaning in terms of like getting to the customer and extracting the value out of them. If you think about let's think about our military for a quick second, because I think people will appreciate this in Northern Virginia. What's one of the most important recon or intel gathering assignments in military? You know what it is? It's the human intel. It's when we call, we extract some intel, and someone tells us what our adversary is going to do. When you think about wars we won, you think about the language interpreters in the world wars and things like that. We won a lot of battles because people were able to extract, decipher, see patterns, and then say, oh, they're planning to bomb us here. Let's move our ships here. And so I think getting to the customer is always the most important thing to do. I think a big problem in the market intel arena or industry is a lot of companies, they've prioritized scalability over customization. they said, let's just build a tool where we can import all the data and just get as many people signed up as possible. And I think in some ways that's worked for some of those companies initially, but we're seeing the pendulum swing. We know because these companies are coming to us and saying, it's not working for us. We've got to sign up on your subscription. And so I think it's getting more intimacy and, you know, further building out the partnerships with the customer. I talk about three things a lot with our team. I talk about the customer, of course. I talk about curation. So everything we do for our clients is very tailored and curated for them, and that we're focusing on specific things that they given us an indication that they want to know more about. And then, of course, customization. And I think we view curation as a little bit different from a selection standpoint than customization. But I think the big thing for us is we're now working in technology where we were sort of using common tools like email or, basic portals to share intel. Now we're rolling out our own platform. We're getting much more innovative about, you know, how we deliver the market intel. So we can take the same scalability or force multiplier of getting a lot of information for a lot of people, but do that with the customer perspective. And we call it voice of government because we're actually transcribing the government's voice about what they need into these deliverables. But if we can do that, you're leveraging technology, I think we're going to be a lot more successful. I think the upside's enormous for us. I think we could be easily a 50, 60, $100 million business if we can continue to make our solution more widely available and democratize the data. I hate to say the best because everyone says they're the best. I would say we're known as the most sophisticated or the most accurate, but you're going to, you know, we're not the cheapest, right? Like, and we're not crazy expensive, but we're more than what a basic BD database would be. And so I think if we can get that same level of intel that's high quality, customer focus, and lower price points and sort of figure out a way to democratize data, I think that's a recipe for massive success for us.
Well, how much of the market have you penetrated? Because I start to wonder too, like, do you run out of runway? You know, it's amazing the number of contractors, but still, could you run out of runway in your market?
Yes, the answer is you could, but I think by that time we would be, if we did that, then we're having immense success. I mean, but there's what, 50 to 100,000 companies that sell to the federal government that have prime contracts somewhere in there, depending on what you're looking at. And like even the big businesses we work with, so like we work with IBM, but we're sort of in their health group and we're now starting to talk to their global business services group. But the big companies have like 100, their divisions are like 100 medium-sized companies in one big company. One big company has 100, 150, 200, maybe 300 different selling opportunities within one large business. And then you've got thousands and thousands of small businesses. We've just scratched the surface, frankly, on, you know, our market. So I'm one of those people who tries to veer away from like, if we just get 10% of this market, we'll be successful. Cause it's like, yeah, but you know how hard it is to get 10%. And so some of the best businesses in the world haven't even got 10% of their market. So, but I think for us, I think there's plenty of opportunity. And I think there's also, Derek, we're seeing a lot more people that are in the private sector that want to start bringing technology and private sector innovation to government. I mean, the government, people forget the government's the largest buyer in the world, And that's part of our problems, right? Like that's why people are upset about the deficit and the debt growing. And so I think the opportunity will always be there. And who knows, you know, maybe there's some replication across what we're doing in the public sector and the private sector that we'll have to tap into and do some R&D on into the future. I certainly don't think we feel the need to do that right now because there's still an ocean of opportunity within federal.
So Derek and I, we do employee benefits for companies, and largely because of the area that we're in, it's most of the time government contractors. And it's kind of this running joke of like, we kind of can see just by talking with the executives at a government contractor of whether we think that they're going to grow based on how they're structured, their benefits, their vision. And it seems as if, I mean, there's so many small government contractors who are trying to make it. And I feel like you all, Alphabrook, like you're helping them see what's below the surface. What advice do you have for those companies who are trying to make it?
Yeah, it's a great question. I had to figure out where I would start with that. I think I would say my very first piece of advice for, if you're saying a company that's trying to make it, I would just assume that might be more of a fledgling company, a company that's maybe either trying to transition into public sector or just getting started as a federal contracting company. I would say in the private sector, if you can find your own buyers and you've got a good product or service, you can do well. What's crazy about the government is even if you're talking with a government person and you've got a good product or service, you still can do really poorly because of all the compliance and process and regulation. Write a proposal, 12-inch font. It's got to be in by this date. Oh, we need three binders redacted. It's unbelievable. Like, proposal people in the federal contracting world are so inspirational to me. Like, I just don't know how they do it. one of the reasons we started Alphabrick was just to ensure I'd never have to write like government proposals. Well, we give the intel for government proposals, but you know, and we're good. And they probably think what we do, they'd never want to do. But the point is, you know, I think you've got to really appreciate the government protocol and process, because if you sell a deal for 12 months and the customer wants you and you've got it all teed up and you're in SAM and you're a registered small business or whatever, and then you don't write the proposal the right way, then it's all void. And so, and then what's tricky about that though, is there's plenty of companies that are compliant and then they can't reach the customer, or they have sort of a developing product or service that's not fully mature and it's not as impressive. They're going to struggle too. I think sometimes people think, oh, well, the private sector is more competitive than the government sector. I don't know that I believe that, because you've got to deal with all of this sort of, I don't know if esoteric is the right word, but it's definitely nuanced. And once you sort of learn how to write proposals, you get into a good groove, you figure out how to get proposal talent and all that, you can really scale and grow. But then you got to get people badged. You got to find talent. You got to find physical space. You got to get people deployed to projects. You got to get clearances. It's really a tour de force is what I say from an administrative standpoint. So I would say if you're getting into federal contracting, make sure you read books, you know, go pay someone to spend time with you for an hour or two if they're not willing to do it for free, and tell you, go into it very clear-eyed about everything that's required from an administrative standpoint, because it's a big deal. And I don't mean to discourage people. I just mean to say that you could do a lot of things right and still have a lot of failure. And then the reason we exist is we're working with companies that might be earlier, but a lot of our clients are pretty sophisticated, right? They've been around, they're $50, $100 million businesses. We've got a lot of smaller ones too, but they actually know how to do everything right. They're still losing deals because they just don't understand the customer well enough. So that's sort of the piece where we'll come in and really give that customer perspective. But of course, idea matters. I think in federal contracting, some people grow their business based on who calls them. It's like if someone calls and wants help desk support, oh yeah, and they'll go find three people to do help desk support. And someone calls and is like, we need our lawn mowed. Like, okay, I can find a mowing company. And they just sub it all out. I think if you're doing that, you're already in a commoditized position where you're competing on price. I think one thing that's really stuck with me since starting Alphabrick is the quality of your idea. I remember thinking when we started Alphabrick, it's different, it's really meaningful, it's going to be incredibly hard. But if we fail, we'll never look back and be like, it wasn't a good idea. We're like, this is unique, it's differentiated. And I've heard other people that are really successful in business really talk about the quality of your idea. If you have a bad idea, it's really hard to get up every day and work hard on that. You'll know deep down that a million other people are doing that, or that it's not really meaningful in terms of, you know, the output to your stakeholders, whether that's your partners or customers or whoever it is, your shareholders.
I think it's really good advice, you know, especially when you think about the ability to outsource a problem, you know, to a degree, right? I mean, you've got a problem, whether it's a understanding the client problem, writing proposal problem, finding the work problem. You know, there's a lot of companies out there that want to insource everything because they can control it. But you're right. I mean, go back to what you said early. Every proposal you send, you know, that's something that the business is paying for, and that's coming out of the owner's pocket. So will that be profitable or not? I think it's just good advice to think about.
Yeah. And we, you know, there's other things we've done at Alphabrick that we've developed over time. We have this cool thing we called around ideas. We call it name it, claim it. And it's just some silly phrase we made up, but everyone in the company knows what it means. Here's what it means. Someone's like, hey, Matt, we just solved this problem and we know how, or we just solved this key operational problem, but you got to do these three steps. And as long as people do these three steps, they never have to worry about the problem. You know what I say to people? I'm like, give it a name, baby, give it a name. Because if you give it a name, people will be like, why is that? What's that mean? What does process X mean? Whoever created that will be like, well, this means this. You do these three steps. And then what's really cool is if you say, hey, let's do OEX on that. Everyone understands, you move out really quickly. I found that the military is like this. You know, when human lives are on the line, they're staying codes. They got shortcuts. They're getting things done really quickly. And we're like that too. And so we talk a lot about name and claim. It's like when I had my first child, you know, part of being a parent and taking that child is you give that child a name. It's a, my boy is Brady. He's my 7-year-old. I love him and his brothers, but it's like, hey, Brady, you're mine. And, you know, sometimes I'm getting a little sappy here. Sometimes I'll say, hey, Brady, do you know why I love you? And, you know, he's like, no, he goes, what, you play with me or I'm a good boy? I said, no, I don't love you because you're a good boy. So you know why I love you? He's like, no, I don't know, Dad. It's like, because you're mine. You know, you're mine. And I think that in life, things don't become real until you name it. And you can grow to love those things and really those can be create immense joy. an immense like operational efficiency. We've got a lot of things like that where around ideation. So, and I think that's a big sort of a carry on from the previous comment about if you're going to build a business, just make sure it's something that has huge impact where you can differentiate yourself pretty quick. That's the advice I'd give, getting back to Jess's question.
That's awesome. Now, I really appreciate it. So Matt, if people are looking to get in touch with you, what's the best way to do that?
Probably my work email. It's pretty simple. It's Matt, M-A-T-T, at Alphabrook, Alphabrook.com. We joke at Alphabrook that all the OGs got the first name at Alphabrook.com. Our website is Alphabrook.com, of course, and you can go on there and submit information if you're interested. And I love connecting with people, so you know, would love to connect with other business leaders or just, you know, other people that have interesting ideas or are looking to do big things in the Northern Virginia area.
Well, we really appreciate you coming on the show today.
Thank you guys. This was a lot of fun and it's really exciting to see what you're doing. I think it's an awesome podcast and it's good to see some representation in specifically the Northern Virginia area because it's a fascinating area with a lot of exciting things going on. So thanks for having me.
Thank you for tuning in. You can listen to this episode and subscribe to future episodes on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to give us that 5-star review so that we can get our podcast out to more and more listeners. If you are a business leader or know of any business leaders that you would like to nominate to be a guest on the show, please visit us at thenovabusinesspodcast.com.